amazing.
All right, wonderful to see everybody back at the Beit Midrash. We're here at Perek Shmini of Yoma, the eighth chapter of Yoma, Yom Kippur, all the rituals. Last time we saw that there were themes that jumped out at us in terms of considering the mitzvah of afflicting oneself. And in those themes, we had a relationship between human beings and the world around ourselves, hot, cold, real elements that we deal with, the elements of the world around us, and we can sometimes suffer the extremes or make ourselves suffer the extremes if we were to say we were going to afflict ourselves that way. We talked about afflicting ourselves through food and understanding that we're restricting ourselves from eating, meaning that we weren't even going to touch the kind of consecrated meat, and we were going to be careful in terms of our ritual practice when it came to thinking about ourselves as temple goers. And by the way, that was an invocation of the religious imagination, that we needed to see ourselves doing that even if it was past the temple being destroyed kind of time, that we could see ourselves being very careful by way of being ritual participants within the Beit HaMikdash culture, which is really important by way of the entire project of the Gemara, when we talk about what does it mean to be a Jew and have at the core of some core of our experience the notion that we could imagine ourselves like our ancestors did participating in that ritual kind of life, or at least appreciating, as we've made mention of several times, not only here in the Beit Midrash, but also in services, our ancestors had a spiritual kind of pursuit of their own, and that included temple worship. And what do we do with that? The rabbis were willing to say, what do we do with that? We include it in the annals of our history. We don't excise it from the annals of our recorded religious history. We include it in the Mishnah. We include it in the Gemara. We include it as a kind of historical era, epic, spiritual pursuit that deserves a place within our ritual life, and therefore we'll still have a Kohen come up to the Torah at first. Therefore we'll still give primacy of place to a Kohen who leads the blessing over the meals at the end of a meal. This kind of temple engagement is part of our ritual liturgy. Of course, Yom Kippur being one of the biggest days that we go over the liturgy of a temple service, right? The avodah. So we saw nature, we saw eating, we saw temple, we saw a relationship to history, and the history, the core historical story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, going out of Egypt. I told you that I was going to start today by taking us into an article that I had prepared for us concerning some of the earliest mentions of fasting. Because still, in terms of ritual studies, we were willing to ask the question, where did this kind of affliction come from, being that it's an affliction of fasting? We saw in Psalm 35, that in verse 13 over there in that psalm, it combines our verb and our kind of sense that through the la'anodet ha'nefesh, through the affliction of the soul, you could indeed fast and thusly provoke or beseech God to get what you need, to get what you want, to get the rain in its season. And so the psalmist knew that, right? The question about Psalms and where they are in terms of literature at any given time in the great canon can be asked. Where are these Psalms and how late are they or how early are they? So I don't really know about Psalm 35. There's not real agreement on it yet. I'm waiting for my friend Dr. Professor Ben Summers' volume to come out from the JPS Tanakh series, where he is going to truly explicate each of the Psalms in the new JPS commentary on Psalms that's due any year now. You can't say any day now with such a scholarly project because there are scholars who are contributing and the editor himself sometimes gets derailed because he's invited to Hebrew University to give lectures that overturn major concepts of biblical studies that we have taken for granted for decades, right? But it'll come soon. But anyhow, there's this other living liturgical community, Jewishly involved community, that is different from the rabbinic Jewish world per se, though somewhat has some relationship to it, and that is the world of Qumran. That's the world of the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's the world of the Essenes. That's the world of the Qumran sect. You know, again, there's no absolute agreement as to what to even call these people. Maybe there were two different distinct communities over there, but has anyone visited the site of Qumran?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a wonderful visit. The area there, literally, it's a small archaeological site by way of, it's not, you know, massive and expansive. It's not an entire old city type of experience where you walk in and can walk around even as big as the top of Masada, but it's substantial enough, and you see kind of where they had some of their rituals done and where they lived and the storehouses and all kinds of different elements over there near the Dead Sea of how they lived. And of course, our greatest treasure trove were the findings of the scrolls that we were able to purchase in all those wonderful right ways, or however we worked that out from folks, and got the scrolls into the Heichala Sefer, the special center for the book at the Israel Museum. But what I want to do is just explicate a little bit more about kind of the roots of where we see fasting from this community, from this community's texts, but go through the article quickly with you to give you, again, more background as to how we get to a Yom Kippur experience that includes fasting, especially as to, you know, afflict our souls. So we have a clash between the Qumran community and the temple priesthood. So back yourself up to that moment where the priesthood is still there and the Qumran community is there. And it concerns the wicked priest who pursued the righteous teacher. Because remember, the righteous teacher at Qumran is the lead voice here in how we live our, and express our religious understandings. And at the time appointed for rest, Shabbat Shabbaton, in our language, on the Day of Atonement, he made his appearance before them to overwhelm them and to cause them to stumble on the fast day, the Sabbath of their rest. Now this means that the teacher and the community there was obviously observing a fast on Yom Kippur, on what they called Yom Kippur. And it apparently looks like the wicked priest, which was presumably one of the temple officials, where Yom Kippur lies, right? Seven chapters of what's gone on in the temple before we get to how are you going to keep and do Yom Kippur in our eighth chapter of the Masechta that we're learning. The priest comes and he says that there's a really big problem with the calendar over here, guys. You're doing it wrong. You've got the wrong day. And as a result, biblical festivals are regularly observed by the Qumran community on days that differ from those of the temple. And to now, we understand that they were observing their holidays on days different from contemporary Jews. This is one of the major issues. Who controls calendar, right? They become, in a certain way, the hegemonic leadership. If you control the calendar, you've got control of the community. And so they were looking to get people to live in their own kind of liturgical realities. You know, this is what the Gregorian Reform was all about. Fast forward. We're going to have a wonderful, give you the foreshadowing, we're going to have a wonderful Lucy lecture this year about some of those calendar issues that come later on and the encounter that Jews have with the Gregorian Reform. So leave that aside. This was one of those moments for the Jewish people ourselves. There's big questions about the community. And what happens is that we see through what the Qumran writings portray for the Yom Kippur festival is that there was liturgy created, a thanksgiving sort of psalm that has at its core joy and the notion of thanks to God. I thank you, Lord, for you have illuminated my face through your covenant. The opponents mislead your people by smoothing them with words. Preachers of deceit cause them to stray. They plot wickedly against me to exchange your Torah, which you inculcated in my heart, for smooth things to deceive your people. They withhold the drink of knowledge from the thirsty, but cause the thirsty to drink vinegar in order to gaze at their error. Lama'an habet el tavutam, to deport themselves foolishly on their festivals, and to be caught in their snares. And this represents both a paradoxical aspect of Yom Kippur on this day that's supposed to be joyous. They are ensnaring us, and this is causing lots of problem for the righteous teacher, Qumran Sect, Sons of Light, whatever you want to call them, the Essenes. And this is a real dilemma on a day that was so important in their tradition and faith. Now, so far, they caused us to drink vinegar on a day that was so important, is where we heard in that small kind of documents thus far. But how do we know that they were fasting and causing us to drink was breaking a fast? Because there's another document that refers directly to it being a day of a fast. And that document is the Damascus document, and not a historical document about the righteous teacher. So the document I was quoting you from was a document about the righteous teacher. But when it comes to the Damascus document, he's going to say that what they did is they broke our Yom HaTa'anit. And the word Ta'anit is the word for fast in the ancient world, especially. It was Masechet Ta'anit, not Tzom. If you've heard the word Tzom, that was the word, by the way, in our psalm for fast. But Ta'anit is the word for fast in the Damascus document, and there's where we get the sense that really what they're breaking and causing us to drink vinegar, which sounds just like sour grapes on this day, is really they're causing us to drink on this day, and it is sour to us because it is a fast day. They are breaking our Yom Kippur.
I when you first read that, I thought that drinking of vinegar was a metaphor.
Right, and so what we are seeing is that it maybe was that they said either drink this kind of wine, it's a day of festivity, celebrate this day with us, because Yom Kippur is either already passed or it's not here yet. It's the wrong day. Drink wine. Be festive. And what better way, if you're from the temple, than to provide joy and libation for the group, as opposed to asking anyone to fast on this day that your righteous teacher is telling you to fast and afflict your soul. Right? So maybe they brought with them some of the temple wine.
The Gregorian adjustment had to do with mathematical adjustment with celestial events. This sounds like it's different.
Oh yeah, this is very different. I'm just simply paralleling the kind of power struggles that go on.
This is a reinterpretation.
This is a total reinterpretation.
Okay.
Yeah. Not to make exact parallels. The Damascus document, part of this community's text and what we've recovered from, you know, the Dead Sea Library, the Scrolls Library, has a particular concept about the nature of Yom Kippur then, and that is that it's a Yom Ta'anit, and it presumably derives from the biblical injunction that we've seen in our Gemara, Ta'anu et nafshotechem, that you should afflict your souls, and therefore the word Ta'anu itself becomes associated with the word Ta'anit. Here, explicitly, the word fast is associated with the word afflict, and therefore afflict seems to be not only afflict, but I could translate fast. Let your soul fast. Let the people of Israel fast. Ta'anu et nafshotechem. And this Damascus document reads Tefillah Liyom HaKippurim Zechura Adoni Moed Rachamecha Veit Shuv. It's a season. Yom Kippur is a season of remembering God, doing a celebration, engaging in the Shabbat Shabbaton at the right time of year. God's merciful at this period. And it's a Veit Shuv. It's a season of repentance. Utkaimam aleinu moed ta'anit. And at that appointed time, we have a fast. Chok olam. It's an absolute law for our community. So here is really where we see that the fast idea takes hold, at least documentary-wise, in the ancient world. Now, was there a parallel fast for the day of Yom Kippur that was also written into some scroll or another that was burned during temple times or not recovered because we didn't have a library like the Dead Sea Scrolls library kept and preserved these scrolls? The answer is we can't really know. We can't really know. But what we do see is that La'anot et nashotechem, instead of just being now translated afflict your souls, turns into fast, you people of Israel, based on the reality of the Damascus document and the evidence we have that Ta'anit, and even, you could say, Masechet Ta'anit and Yom Ta'anitenu, the day of our fasting, maybe this was where that language turned into the language of fasting. Perhaps neither the temple scroll that had it that we can't find or the Dead Sea Scroll is the actual root text when it comes to Ta'anit being a fast. Perhaps it's not. Because we do have some indication in Tanakh that we have fasts, and the language of Tanakh helps us know through the same use of the root that we have some days that we're fasting. But Yom Kippur, particularly, we don't really have it associated with. We learn those verses. And those verses said, La'anot et nashotechem, five times, but it wasn't associated with the Psalm of Psalm 35, the Ta'anit that appears elsewhere, and the Ta'anit that specifically could have come around before Qumran or before any kind of instruction manual in the temple. And so thusly, though, we have our first real extant evidence, textual evidence, Damascus document, becomes our evidence for where that language comes together on Yom Kippur Day. Interestingly, at a time when the righteous teacher of the Qumran community is being challenged by the temple high priest who says, you've got it wrong, reminding us that that argument about calendar will be part of what really is coming to life when we have other arguments about the calendar between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua. We have it right inside the Gemara itself. We have arguments about what day is Yom Kippur and calendar arguments. And they're reflected, these kind of arguments with the sect are reflected even among our own. In Masechet Brachot, for instance, when we have an argument about the day of Yom Kippur. So it's a fascinating beginning. There are other kinds of pieces that are revealed about Yom Kippur in some of the texts that are extant around that time of the Qumran community. Jubilees is a text that's outside our canon and rabbinic corpus, but very important in terms of a study of texts of that age and era. And in that, there are descriptions of the spirit of a ta'anit as well, of a fast for Yom Kippur. And the spirit there, though, is to make sure that there's a little bit of more like grief and mourning about the day and a sense of real consideration of mortality and to link fasting with this kind of awareness of one's mortality and thusly one's life and the gratitude one can find in that kind of perspective. That's as opposed to a separate scroll found otherwise with that's named 4Q51015, if you're interested. And that says that whatever the Yom Kippur fast meant, it also has the power to thrust away demons and expel them from our midst who threaten to entice us towards evil. Right? So an outward look, what are demons in the Gemara and what are demons at that time? Kind of outward forces outside of us, forces that want us to do evil, versus what becomes for the rabbis an alternative to that, which is the interiority of the human being that has both a Yetzirah Tov and a Yetzirah, an inclination for good and an inclination for evil. And so the demons represent that kind of pull towards the dark side. And that's as opposed to the inner life of the human being, which has an inclination towards good, and yet is drawn to be evil through the inclination for evil. So you can try to get rid of the demonic powers. The only evidence left of any of that, or how that links into other kinds of realities that we see in our normative faith, or the texts that we call our canon, is that, you know, no one really knows what that second goat going to Azazel is really all about. Right? And Azazel might be the cliff, and it might be a place, and it might be the strength of, it might be, you know, giving ourselves over to the strength of God, Azazel, meaning Oz from El, strength from God, or it might be that there's some demonic force that we feel is kind of creeping at the door. In the ancient, most ancient kind of ritual kind of ways that we looked at Yom Kippur and the Yom Kippur goat sacrifice. So fascinating beginnings, possibilities. This Qumran view of the period of affliction has to be contrasted with two interesting accounts of rejoicing on Yom Kippur preserved in our Mishnah. So despite the fact that we are dealing with a Yom Tanit and afflictions of the soul, we should keep this in mind, and it's good for us to keep in mind as we go back to our Gemara, because there's a great joy that is reported and recorded in the Mishnah and Gemara. Yom Kippur is not only a day of great kind of, you know, get in touch with mortality and peel away layers of humanity and talk about the sinful nature of the last year. Not original sin, by the way. But it's a day of joy, and one concerns the celebration of the high priest and his friends when he emerged unscathed, and that liturgy is still left in our Machzor. And it was a great celebration, and he made a big celebration after completing, Yom Tov Haya Oseh Lo Avav. He made a great yontiv, the high priest, for when he exited the Holy of Holies and all the work of the Beit HaMikdash, B'sha'ashi Yatzah B'shalom Min HaKodesh, when he came out in wholeness and in peace from the work that he did at the temple. And the day is also called the Day of Great Jubilation on our calendar because it was a day that was really, really known as one that could be about the potential Jewish future. It kind of made everybody equal. And just like Tu B'Av, the 15th of Av in our calendar, which is post-Tisha B'Av, was a day where brides and grooms met one another and the Jewish people could see a future because families of Israel would come together, Yom Kippur had a little bit of that as well, according to our rabbinic tradition, where it was a day that in the great gathering of people we could see a future for ourselves, both in terms of potential people meeting one another, but just in the greatness of the gathering of the people. And that really provides energy for the future. And that, I believe, is part of why we gather today, to this day, Ad HaYom HaZeh, in great numbers at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. There is just something so energizing about being in that multitude of our family, of the Jewish people. The early Tanaitic tradition, that the surprisingly joyous aspect is preserved in the folkloristic account of dancing and matchmaking on Yom Kippur, found in Mishnah Ta'anit, and even in the fasting Masechta, 4:8. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel said, there were no more festive days, Yamim Tovim, for Israel than the 15th of Av, and Yom Kippur, for on them the daughters of Jerusalem would go out and dance in the vineyards. And what would they say? Young man, raise your eyes and see what you choose for yourself. Direct not your eyes at beauty, but at family. Grace is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. So the merrymaking and the matchmaking and the possible family that's part of the Yom Kippur experience in rabbinic literature sits in contrast somewhat to the depth of affliction that we see, except to say that it connects us with all of the pillars of our religious ideals and ideas and stories, as we looked at last time. And now we'll continue into the Gemara's exploration of, particularly since it was such a strong aspect of what was going on for commemorating this day, we'll go further into the meaning of fasting as la'anot et nafshotechem, as the verb, yes, means afflict in all different kinds of ways, but really centers us, at least at the beginning and the start, on the mitzvah of fasting and on that practice of fasting at the right moment, at the right day of Yom Kippur, for all generations to come. And that's where we're headed back into our Gemara today, and we're going to see how the Gemara today explores more about fasting. What are we to concentrate upon if we want to deepen our relationship with this inui nefesh, with this ta'anit, with this fast of Yom Kippur? What's the, you know, what's the study material you put on your curriculum, you put on your platter, if you really want to relate to this more? And it will have both historical aspects, and it will have very, very much physical aspects, because we're going to talk about food more. And we're going to talk about, instead of fasting and the experience of fasting, we're going to talk about food. Which again, like, ironically, you could have talked about the experience of fasting and what one should have in mind when one fasts and how one achieves that and what do you eat beforehand and all of this kind of thing. But what we're really going to do is talk about the historical nature of this. Is about a lot about the man in the wilderness, and it's going to talk about the morality and ethical and moral kind of practice we can build in life through food and food justice. It's going to mention sex life, but then steer right back into the whole question of food. We're going to have insights about food as a potential instrument of justice in the world. Talk about maybe a reflection of God's justice is through food and what we do with food justice. I'm pushing the Gemara to say that, I admit, but it's here. There's a relationship to food and how we have a relationship to food, just in general, like human beings' relationships to food, as a focus point for Yom Kippur. If you look at this Gemara material and you say, why are we fasting and what are we doing? There's the whole notion of vis-a-vis the relationship with food. Issues about kashrut are going to come up. And they're going to use this place to talk about kashrut. They're going to talk about the earth. They're going to talk about faith through food while you're fasting.
That's the best thing.
Right, why not? Why not?
You think about it most times.
So that's where we're headed today. What do you think of our Qumran friends?
If I understood it correctly, so we're using the Qumranic documents to explain what they do, or what do we? But the only dispute with the temple was what day it was, not the practice.
Right, and a little bit of whether or not, and a little bit of the question of what is the very nature of their Yom Kippur day. We don't have potentially enough text to really say whether or not they record the same kind of day, joy and jubilation, in the two examples that I brought you from the Mishnayot that we quote. Perhaps it was more about the penitential nature of religiosity and religious practice versus the joy and the joyous nature of such a Shabbaton. From what I can see so far, as people read more of the documents and mine them for more, maybe we'll have more insight. But, right, we're comparing, contrasting, and seeing if The rabbis exactly do it the same way. Same themes are there. And also noting that they indeed wrote very concretely that it was a day of fasting. And, you know, asking the question, willing to ask the question, did we do it so that there would be no argument with the other groups, especially with that group, who said, yes, Yom Kippur is a day of fasting in addition to all whatever we do in the temple. And that is an expression of personal connection with this, because not everybody can be the high priest and do the work in the temple. They had to find ways that individually people could connect in when it said in the Torah, La'anod et nashotechem.
Do we know the philosophy by which they made the choice of a different day?
I don't know the exact philosophy, other than to say that the righteous teacher, whose scroll we have, seems to have rulership over the calendar. We know about another sect or other type of approach Judaically, and that is the approach of the Karaites, and if they are either the progenitors of the Karaites or in relationship with any people who are Karaitic at that time in their approach, or if they themselves use the same, we would know that they interpreted, say, the second Sabbath, the Shabbat after the Pesach one, right, as the Shabbat to come, as opposed to the second Seder, as opposed to the second day of Passover. And so that in and of itself would throw off any calendaring into the future. So if I interpret one verse from the Torah in a different way than the Rabbinite Jews, we usually use rabbinic for the classical period, so I'll try to keep doing that. But more and more I'm stuck with this word Rabbinite, because that is the term we're now seeing come to play with the Rabbinite versus the Karaite communities in Fustat and Alexandria, and a little later on, 8th century, 9th century, 10th century, 11th, 12th. But who knows if that wasn't the beginning of the real discussion.
You know, the Christians have it with the Greek Orthodox Church. They have different days and different sites. You know, when you go in Jerusalem, it'll take you to a different place.
Yeah. And in that light, like, isn't it amazing? Outside of the Karaite community that still exists in very, very small numbers, or Jews who have a different calendar, we generally have calendar agreement around the Jewish world, globally. That's pretty cool, if you think about the possibilities, the alternative possibilities. And then, of course, if you live in Israel, you get one day of Yom Tov versus two, if you're observant and you have to figure out where you stand on that, if you have lived in Israel and then you come back to Australia.
That's not a matter of dates. That's not a matter of calendar.
That's not a matter of dates. That's a matter of just
shaychut. Second observation. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Good? Let's move to some Gemara. Okay, let's go to page 74B. Let me figure out which one it's on. Okay, go to the very end of 74B. It's 74B4. We're at the very bottom of the page. Dibom achil ki yiten bakos eno. 74B. 74B4.
The first phrase.
74B on 375.
Okay.
Down at the bottom, last section.
Okay.
Ki ten bakos. See it there?
Yeah.
Good. All right. So ki ten bakos eino yitalech b'meisharim. So there was a discussion before with a dispute between Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, and that's why I get another dispute with Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi. You could say that sometimes the Gemara simply like indulges in bringing you a list of the disputes that two scholars have, if they mention two scholars. I'm like, hey, let's see what else these guys disagreed about for a second. You know, kind of like the same discursive conversation that we have sometimes at our dinner tables. You know, we mention something, didn't he make that other movie? And then we come back. But sometimes those disputes are le'ikar. They are to the you know, essence of what we're discussing to begin with, and so too will this be. And mind you, keep in mind, as we learn these texts and think about this Gemara, we were exploring what affliction really means, and how we know there's affliction, and what we do to afflict our souls, and Yom Kippur, and here we go talking about this. Right? So it says, do not look upon the wine when it is red, when it gives its color in the cup, when it glides down smoothly. Rabbi Ami v'Rabbi Asi chadamar kol hanotein eino v'choso. I'm on now 75A1. Anybody who really puts eyes on his cup and keeps drinking and keeps drinking and keeps drinking and says, oh, my eyes are on my cup, it's empty, and gets more. And we say that either he's habitually drunk, or Rashi says in a different way, ohev shichrut, that he loves being drunk. So there's a difference between one who's intoxicated habitually and a person who really loves the feeling of being intoxicated. Not to say that he wouldn't be habitually drunk, but Rashi points out that there's a certain matter of, like, I love a glass of wine. And so, not sure if he's all the way drunk, if he loves a glass of wine. Whichever way you want to go with that. But, let's put it this way, the Gemara is going to say, if he drinks enough, and he drinks enough at a time, arayot kulan domot alav kamishur. He is going to have forbidden relationships all the time. He's going to not be able to control himself in terms of the relationships he needs to keep kosher. He'll become unaware of pitfall. He'll become someone who really has illicit relationships, and it won't be good for him, and it won't be good for his family. Now, the other partner to the machloket is v'chadamar, kol anotein eino v'choso. What does it really mean? That whoever casts his eyes into the cup, in other words, whoever really has his eyes on his cup, kol ha'olam kulo domei alav kamishur, the entire world seems to him like mishur, a plane, level ground. So if I drink enough, right, and I can't really make, through the power of my judgment, discernment about the level ground in front of me, God knows I'm going to lose my way when it comes to illicit sexual relationships. God knows I'm going to lose my way when it comes to making decisions about anything that I'm supposed to take seriously in terms of gvulot, borders, rules, boundaries in my life. So there's several different reasons why I think that the Gemara goes here kind of right after this whole discussion about afflictions and Egypt and keeping yourself from eating the wrong kind of thing, and people with bread in their basket and without bread in their basket. There's one little insertion here about wine. It says, come back. Let's say you're a kind of person where hunger is not like, you don't have to worry that man is coming from heaven for a minute. Bring you back down to, quote-unquote, your reality. You have wine, you have food, you're a person who can enjoy what is enjoyable. If you drink too much of it, you could become quite sinful in your nature. And one of the kavanot, one of the intentions that Yom Kippur fasting provides for you, yes, we just talked about history and the man, and by the way, we're going to return to it in a couple of minutes and explore it in a little bit more depth, is, okay, but you have to figure out if in your time, in your life, in your reality right now, Rav Asi, Rav Ami are saying that you're just a little bit too, like, let's say, loose and carefree about keeping the boundaries and the borders going for whatever is your either commandments that you have to understand you have to do as a religious Jew, or how you are going to live your life religiously in the context of this community and in your time. Because the notion of having wisdom literature appear for us after a discussion of deriving the notion of afflicting our souls vis-a-vis don't eat, don't drink, getting to wine says there's another element of this, and that is control your inhibitions. Remember that in the Torah, Aaron, the high priest, is warned, no drinking when it comes to doing the holy work in the Mishkan. Right? That's one of the first places we get the warnings about wine in Torah. So whenever there's a warning about too much wine, we're also, in our hypertext Jewish minds, remembering that there was a warning back then as well. That it not only can lead to illicit sexual relationships, but they don't even have to say the word, and I'm remembering, and also the world becomes a very dangerous place even when I think I'm doing religious work. You know, did that part come in the Torah after the death of Aaron's sons at the altar, remember? It comes right after that. Because really, they were doing the tailgating before the big party at the Mishkan? Were they getting set for the day, and were they intoxicated, inebriated, and paid with their lives when it came to the big fire and the production of the fire, the fireworks that were necessary for beginning this major dedication of the Mishkan in the desert? That hypertext to this passage, to me, stands, despite its not being mentioned here. Because when you talk about in the midst of Yom Kippur, the notion that you shouldn't become too inebriated, immediately it's also referring to your self-control with wine at yontivs and meals and every day, and that episode in Torah when it comes to the work of the Mishkan.
Are you saying that in the Torah it says that they were drinking?
No, it doesn't say that explicitly, but what I'm suggesting is that the warning about not drinking, doing the holy work of the Mishkan, comes after the death of his children to tell us, possibly, it's my commentary on the Torah.
Okay. I remember the story, but I don't remember the...
That we have to be very careful to not be inebriated when it comes to the holy work we do, and the holy work we do.
Is there a midrash about the sons and why? There must be things.
Oh, there are many.
And do they suggest this as well?
No, it's my brain.
It's interesting if it's linked together, if they're so close together, we often make that connection.
Right, exactly. It's smichut ha-parashiyot, if you will. It's the closeness of one segment or story of the Torah to another central part of the narrative, right? But it's more a literary hyperlink. And since it's situated here, and we're exploring the nature of our transgressions and our sins and what creates righteous boundaries and what breaks those righteous boundaries down, I want to suggest that that's the way that the Gemara in this perek can work. And we're not just talking about how to understand this verse. We're talking about this being the curriculum for our understanding of everyday life, as discursive as sometimes it is, inserted like this because of the connection to this sage's name. Did you have some?
No.
And of course, the exception is poor.
Well, there are a few exceptions to when for drinking, right? We have learned about the Purim stories, and we saw in Masechet Megillah together, vis-a-vis Purim, the warning, right, that one sage got so drunk, inebriated to the point where he killed his friend. You know, big warning. You know, that sugya comes back around now and then every couple of years to be of interest as we explore the mitzvah of simcha and drinking and drunkenness on Purim. So maybe you're reminding me this year we should take a look at it again. What a sugya that is.
You did say a minute ago, two and as opposed to just an
That's right. That's right. And I do think that there's a difference and a distinction. You know, at what point do you lose a little control? Are you without enough inhibition? So let's go on and see the next little piece, because the next little piece is not continuing with wine.
Sorry, but you know, I had read about in the last couple of years that some Orthodox synagogues were having whiskey and whatever at a certain point during the Shabbat service. They were going out and drinking, and then.
Yeah, that was a popular kind of thing called the Kiddush clubs.
How could you do that if you're not supposed to do this in the temple ceremony? Then how could they accept that to be drinking during?
Well, they weren't too inebriated. they would have enough. They ohev kitzat. They liked this feeling. It was for camaraderie and chevership as much as it was for, you know, actually getting drunk, and. Was it a great example? The OU came out with an entire policy about it, the Orthodox Union. They didn't really like the culture that it created, and they encouraged shuls.
But now that you're reading this, I would think that it really is not a good idea, because we already have something now in writing about how you really don't mix that.
Well, here we have in writing a little bit of a warning. It's not saying that we're forbidding it. Remember, we're not the community religiously that says absolutely no l'chaim and absolutely no drinking. There are communities who decided that that would be their policy. It just wants you to be aware that too much leads to serious licentiousness.
So what was the OU's policy?
The OU encouraged rabbinic leaders and boards to discourage the practice of Kiddush clubs and have out loud conversations and communications with community about the notions of responsible drinking, about appropriate l'chaims, timing during or not during services, letting people know who are in recovery that they respect the fact that they won't choose in, we're not pressuring anyone, and that there's grape juice and other beverages available at Kiddush versus just a scotch, and that beverages should be out. Because some Kiddushes, by the way, were like, you know, a little nosh, a l'chaim, and you're lucky if there was a cup for water, right?
You mentioned Rashi before, but since he was a winemaker.
True.
And he was the president of the Association of Jewish Winemakers.
From what I understand on the big scale at the time, did he feel an obligation that he would write more of a, instead of just a commentary on that? Is there anything by him?
It's interesting. I mean, remember when we saw, because I think we had this conversation back when we did Ben Sorer Moray, the rebellious and the wayward son. Right. Rashi, you know, was enough of an expert to know that what we're really talking about in terms of that kid drinking too much, that was the Italian wine. Not the French stuff, which is okay. You know, what a wonderful reality to reflect upon, right? So, no, do I think, though, that Rashi is attentive by way of his commentary on wine to some detail that we wouldn't get otherwise if he wasn't in the business? I think we can, depend a little bit more on Rashi's understandings of what was and what wasn't stronger versus weaker wine, because he was an expert. All right, so it doesn't dwell on wine here. The next little piece comes along, and it happens to be an insert from Reb Ami and Reb Asi that doesn't really seem to be so much in place. Again, unless you do the work of saying, wait a minute, does this relate to Yom Kippur? Because maybe there's a part of Yom Kippur where people come and they actually feel, and I have sensed this in meeting with some of the community members, where people feel a little anxious about Yom Kippur coming. Anxiety about how they've behaved, about apologizing, about asking for forgiveness, all these things. And the next little piece seems to be very much, very insightful in terms of how we live with anxiety. And, you know, It's in Ashkenazic bones, at least. A little bit of anxiety. Daga v'lev ish yashchena. Scripture is going to state in Proverbs, when there is a worry or dread, v'lev ish, in the heart of a person, yashchena, let him yashchena, whatever that really means. So if I was to ask those who want to take a stab at the Hebrew, what does yashchena really translate to? It's not an easy word.
It's not used in Proverbs.
It's not.
Not at all.
So the reality is that Mefarshim also have a little struggle with this word. Is it sicha? Because though we point it in Masoretic tradition, yashchena, could it be yashchena?
Yeah.
And so that's where it goes. Let him converse about it. Or it could be that it is a verb left over, and it means quash or beat it down, and it's used uniquely in wisdom literature as a squash it or quash it or beat it down. And Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi have a disagreement about it and say, Chad Amar, when it says, one says and the other says, it uses the order of the sages that were presented. So Rabbi Ami and then Rabbi Asi. Rabbi Ami says, Yas chena midato, he should uproot the worry from his mind and talk about it. V'chad amar, yisi chena la'acherim, he should tell it to others. So, yas chena in the first place could mean uproot, according to the Gemara. And you see in the note, when the shin in the word of yashchena is interchanged with sin, we have the word yaschena, and when the sin is further interchanged with the letter samech, the result is yaschena, which connotes akira, uprooting. So they're using the sound to create the drash. One is about uproot it, get that worry out of your heart, figure out a way to uproot that worry, that anxiety, out of your heart set, your mindset. The other is go talk about it, right? And so I mentioned, was it in this class? No, it was in Barry Feldman's class on Sunday. There's a wonderful book called The Jew and the American Soul. And it's a scholarly book by Heintze, if you're into these things, H-E-I-N-T-Z-E, where the scholar explored the beginnings of talk therapy, of pouring out your story and talking through
approach
of talk therapy, right? Forgetting for a moment that you can have talk therapy in a cognitive way or talk in a Freudian modality or gestalt, but talk, right? So here the Gemara is saying, pour out your worry. Now, squash it, beat it down. There are those who think that internally, once we have a dagon, once we have a little anxiety, that it's best to squash it, quash it, quiet it. There are those who would say that that's called avoidance in some way. There are those who would say, no, wait a minute. But avoidance is a healthy tactic sometimes, and squashing things is easy enough because you can fold them into nice little spaces in your mind, and maybe that's a cognitive attack on the worry you're having. And then there are those who really believe in the sicha, in the talk, in a deeper way, or a combination of the both. I'm not being exclusive in terms of the spectrum. Meanwhile, it's here in the Gemara, and it's here on Yom Kippur, which I think is so fascinating. Because it's saying, pour out your conversation about your worries, which will become, in the 19th century, part of Rabbi Nachman's deepest message to his Hasidim about prayer. Pour out your worries in whatever language you need it to be during your tefillah experience, during your prayer experience. Just pour it out. And then the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, the Piazitzna Rebbe, Rabbi Kalman Kalanimus Shapira, we'll create a small treatise about the nature of prayer and the worry that was going on in their experience of life. And he will tell you that da'agah, that worry, is the beginning of your prayer, and that one can either transform that into melody with no words, one can use that language to formulate a request, or one can just pour it out in any language and express it to God, and that becomes the liturgy in between the spaces of the letters of the Siddur. But here's the root. Here's the root.
But either way, it's a method of expiation.
Right. Is it and is it a method of affliction, or is it expiation? Because here it is in the middle of the conversation about affliction. Ah, I feel afflicted, therefore here's a way to bring it out. And there it is, speaking. Yashchena. Delia?
It's so striking, given talk therapy. Do you know of anything else like this in the Gemara? I mean, in our culture, it's a given that talking to someone is a way of working things out, whether it's therapy or a conflict between two individuals. I've never noticed that in other texts, but that doesn't mean
That's really true. First of all, it's not a given in every culture.
And so
you're right. It's not a given in every culture.
Right.
It is in ours in many ways. There are many places that address the possibility that the sicha, that the conversation between us and God and the conversation between us and one another among us is really essential, right? And where they are situated is very important in the way that I see it. And so I'll just give you one other example. In Brachot, when it comes to the end of the Amidah, there's an encouraging word in a general sense, even though you have words of others, to pour out your words in conversation with God, to make your prayer very personal. You could say that the entire culture of machloket and argumentation in some way is at the core of itself how to work out conflict, and in Kiddushin, Masechet Kiddushin, around 31 or 32, page 31 or 32, there's the description of the nature of bringing an argument into the Beit Midrash, and where you started out as enemies. Literally, the term is you wind up coming out lovers, at least lovers of the gateway of Torah. But the idea is that you've somehow harmonized the either harmonized really the agreement, or you've agreed to disagree. And you're no longer in the category of oivim, of enemies. Yeah. So let's push forward and see where it's going to go. So here's another. This one we're going to have to really learn out together. The Nachash Afar Lachmo. Scripture states, and the snake's food is dust. So again, this seems pretty obvious to me why it's in the nature of Yom Kippur. What's a snake really represent in our tradition? What's that?
Temptation.
Temptation in the Garden of Eden. Right? What else? Did you say something about healing?
Or snake is poison.
Right, so you also have poison. And you have snakes that attacked us, poisonous. And then you have the, if you remember, Moses's...
The staff
with turns into snake, but also this, in the wilderness, the caduceus, the snake that's of protective brilliant metal, copper and I can't remember if the staff has gold on it, but you have a snake in lots of different ways. It can both be for protection and miracle, and it can also be for temptation and the beginning of the Garden of Eden story. So here we are in the Garden of Eden of the world. It's even though we're expelled, possibility for our life beyond. And so we get the notions, and the snake's food is dust. Rabbi Ami for Rabbi Asi again. Chad Amar. First one says, Afilu ochel kol ma'adanei olam. Even if a snake eats all the delicacies of the world, to'em v'hem ta'am afar. It tastes in them or to them, only like the taste of dust. That someone, in other words, if you're a curse, like the snake, all will taste like dust. You'll just be eating dust of the earth. V'chad amar, afilu ochel kol ma'adonei olam, even if a snake eats all the delicacies of the world, ein da'ato miyushevet alav ad sheyochal afar. Its mind is not at rest until it eats dust. Whatever that really means.
What does that mean?
Whatever that really means. If someone said, we have to learn this one together. I'm not exactly sure. Steinsaltz says the following. And dust shall be the serpent's food. Listen to the small comment. Serpents eat any type of animal they find and have the ability to differentiate between different kinds of prey. However, because the serpent swallows its prey whole, it does not need or have the sense of taste that other animals have. In this sense, everything it eats tastes like dirt. So is this a warning against what I call achilat gasa? We saw this with the Ben Sorer, the wild, rebellious son. He just ate like a, you know, absolute boar. Just shoveled it in. So they're saying, oh, when you swallow your food whole and you just gulp it down and you don't have appreciation for your food, then you really don't make the right kind of gift of your food and have the right type of gratitude for food. And on your fast day, think about this. It's a possibility. But the Gemara is going to explain a little bit more, bringing you a Braita. Tanya, remember that a Braita is a source that comes from the Tanaitic age that is not in the Mishnah. Could be a quote from Tosefta, but is really on the cutting room floor and brought in to create the argumentation. It's got authority because it's from that kind of early era of the Tanaim, the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Mishnaic era. Amar Rabbi Yossi says, Bo ure'e shelo kamidat HaKadosh Baruch Hu midat basar v'dam. We're going to get a differentiation between how human beings are and behave in the world and how Kodesh Baruch Hu, how God exists. Midat vasar v'dam, it's a characteristic of a man of flesh and blood, machnidet chaviro, that he constantly tries to cut down his fellow. In every which way. You don't like somebody? You don't want good for him. Yored imo l'chayav. He descends upon that person's livelihood as well as everything else. He doesn't want him to make money, he doesn't want any good for him. Aval HaKadosh Baruch Hu eino chein. But God is not like that. Kilel et hanachash, he cursed the primordial serpent that it should eat dust. Olel agag mizanot avimo, but nevertheless, when it ascends to the roof, its food is with it. Yored lamata mizanot avimo, and when it descends below, its food is with it. Right? If you look what it's trying to say is, the bright that teaches that God implants a silver lining of goodness in each dark cloud. In the curse, you have kind of a blessing that can be found.
Meaning whatever level, it'll find food, so it doesn't matter which level. I didn't quite understand.
Right. In other words, it's going to find food no matter where it sneaks
it
and slips and goes.
Level. So
yeah.
If it goes up, it's still the ground.
Right, exactly. By us, by the way, what's the implication? We're not going to find food that easily. We need the earth, we have to tend the field, we have to do the hard work that is all part of that system. Now, what is it about Kilel Kanaan? In other words, there will be people who will be subservient, you think? What's the silver lining that God put into people who are in whatever way subservient in the world? Ochel Masha Rabbo Ochel. He eats what the master of the house eats. V'shotei masha rabo shotei, and he drinks whatever the master of the house drinks. Kalel Taisha, God cursed the woman to have pain in childbirth. Ah, what's the silver lining?
A child.
Ah. Well, in this case, Bobby, the Gemara wants to give men yet again a nice place. Hakol ratzin achareha. Men are going to chase her anyway.
Well,
That doesn't make any sense, right?
Yeah.
I agree.
Okay. And I agree, too. I thought the silver lining should also be. I was waiting for Gemara to say yet again. Oh, it's the child, of course. Yep. Kilel ta'adama, curse the ground. Hakol nizoinin heimena, and all are sustained from it. So the ground has some curse, yet the ground is what provides for us all the food that we need. The Gemara is now going to come back to the man. Because we're now at the earth. Yes, we're fasting. Let's talk food. Zacharnu et hadaga asher nochal b'mitzrayim chinam. We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt, right? Free of charge, chinam. At least free of something. Rav Shmuel. There's an argument. Chad amar dagim. One said that the word daga refers to actual fish, and that the Israelites were really wanting the fish that they ate in abundance in Egypt. V'chad amar arayot. And one said the daga was, no, we ate, quote unquote, we ate fish. We had freedom to eat, like fish were free jumping out of the Nile for us to eat. So too were anybody who we wanted to marry. There were no Torahs yet. It wasn't Sinai. We didn't get the Torah. There was no law and rule about illicit relationships. There weren't so many borders and boundaries. And that's kind of not only for sexual relationships, but that's kind of a bigger commentary on it. We didn't have so many rules and mitzvahs to worry about. Right, and if we were doing a little bit of an exploration about, you know, where else in the Gemara are there attitudes of, really, you had to give me all these rules to live by, you know, revelation and oive, maybe that's like the way I would title that lecture, or oive revelation, really. There are several times when that trope comes up, you know, and now we have to live with all this. Now we have those laws. So that's really what they wanted. The Gemara explains the rationale for each opinion. Man de amar dagim dichtiv nochal, the one who said that daga refers to actual fish, gets that from what's written here. They ate it. Right? The word nochal, it was ate. Uman de amar arayot dichtiv chinam. But the one who really says that it refers to illicit relationships says, I'm learning from this kind of thing like chinam. Because what? For free. But the one who says that it was really about the illicit relationships, but it's written that they ate them. What are you going to do with that word? They ate it. It used a euphemism that ate meant that they entered into these relationships that were illegal. But the one who says they ate fish, what does he do with the word for free? Because here's the problem. You think the Egyptians gave anybody fish for free?
They got fish on their own.
So what's going to happen is they're going to answer, in truth, what the Israelites did is that they didn't have to really purchase fish since they would bring them from public property. The Amamar, as we have a teaching that said, when the Israelites would pull water from the Nile, in other words, or from the rivers, HaKadosh Baruch Hu mazmin lahem betoch hamayim dagim ketanim. There would be lots of little fish in the water that they would pull, and all those fish became the fish that they would make for their meals. Gemara is going to still challenge it, though. B'shlam alaman damar dagim. It's fine if you say it's the actual fish. Aval arayot lo peretzuvu. But indeed, about the illicit relationships, they really didn't have any reason to complain, because they really didn't have any problem with that. They didn't relate to one another like with such anti-Torah attitudes. They kept the Torah, even though they didn't have Torah yet from Sinai. There were no illicit relationships. Well, that's the Gemara's claim. Hainu dichtiv gan na'ul achuti chala. Because the verse says, this is my sister is like a locked garden, chased in her way, the bride, a fountain sealed. Right? We learn from the poetry of Song of Songs that we were really virtuous in Egypt. But according to the one who says, Eila demanda amar arayot, but according to the one who said that the Israelites were recalling the illicit relationships they had in Egypt, my mayan chatum, what's meant by such a sealed fountain then? How does he explain it? What's that?
Well, maybe the women were virtuous, but the men weren't.
No, maybe. There's a good answer.
Sister was, but the brother wasn't.
Mehenat Azirin lo peretzuvahu. The Israelites did not promiscuously engage in those relations that were prohibited to them in Egypt, because Scripture really praises them for it, and their lamentations were only for those relations that were permitted in Egypt, but were subsequently prohibited by the Torah, whatever that is. And there are different kinds of conceptions about what was permitted, and you can see the note down in 25 that there's all kinds of discussion about what is permitted, what isn't. The point is, though, that we're talking about two things that are in the list of our five. We're talking about eating, if it's fish, and missing it, and wondering, you know, kind of, are we missing the fish too much today? It's Yom Kippur. And we're talking about sexual relations, which are asur now, which are forbidden, according to our Mishnah. And we're parsing that out, too, amidst this discussion. So it's interesting that these are the two angles that these two sages are arguing about, because we're to be thinking about how morality in society, ethical decisions need to be made in our lives vis-a-vis both of these matters, food and relationships. And that theme will continue to show itself in the intertwining sometimes of the argumentation, the way that food and sexual relationships are kind of intertwined throughout the discussions, and particularly again because it's so much about food and we're worried about food as the ritual that's at stake and the punishment being karet, we want to make sure no one gets excluded or cut off from our people and pays the big price. We're exploring this even more, and it's going to go back now to Numbers, and it's going to talk a little bit more about the man and food, the food aspect again, because that's really the essence here of the Inui.
These are our strongest appetites, and they're being bounded.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And thrown in there is the appetite for the drink, but perhaps it's not as strong as the food and the relationships, right? And that's why we get so much of it. Okay, so before maybe we go on to this let's do one little piece of this, because it's we mentioned this tradition and it's in here. It's from this part of the Gemara that these traditions come about what it tasted like, this man, right? And again, like, I find this totally ironic that we're talking about, oh, it could taste like anything we want. And we're studying Masechet Yoma, and we're studying about fasting. Et ha-kishuim ve-et ha-avatichim. We remember that the daga we ate in Egypt free of charge, and what was the end of the verse? And the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, and the onions, and the garlic. Right? So this is Egyptian, this is Ashkenazic, this is our menu. This is everything. Rabbi Ahami and Rabbi Asi again. So they're Chadamar, Tam Kol Aminin, Tamu Vaman. They experienced the taste of all food species in the man, in the manna. Turn the page. 75A3 now. Avawat. Ta'am chameshet aminin halalu lo ta'amuvo. But they did not experience the taste of these five species in it. And that was the five foods that are to be avoided, according to the Gemara, and Rashi says it, by pregnant women. And, you know, those five, again, were the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. For whatever reason, I'm not the doc. I don't know if those foods are really in any way dangerous, or they thought they were dangerous at the time, but a book that Barry actually reminded me about by Dr. Prowse, that his colleague and friend, Dr. Rosner, I believe his name is. So he talks about how there are certain foods that over time we understand to be foods to avoid for various kinds of moments of medical concern, pregnancy being one, other foods, you know, affecting diet. And today that trend is for sure, you know, people cutting down on gluten or changing a diet for, you know, this kind of potential that it offers for healing.
Yeah, Rambam had a list of unrecommended foods for pregnant women. I need to check if it's the same list.
Ah, that would be interesting. That would be interesting. So yeah, it'd be good. Check it out.
But you don't think there's something a little interesting that it's the exact same foods that they talked about as being the ones that they long
of
for?
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, if it were just medical, it would be not exactly.
Exactly. And then the other the other one says v'charamar ta'am kol aminin ta'amu ta'aman umamashan, they experience in the mana the complete taste of all the food species, both their taste and their substance. V'halalo ta'aman v'lo mamashan, and in the case of the five species, they experience their taste but not their substance. So did you get the texture experience in addition to the taste experience with the mana? You know, you want to interview somebody from that episode. Not only did you taste the steak, but did it chew like steak? Yeah. And that's kind of what they're arguing about here. But what they're really saying, again, is this, in my estimation. I always think about kind of the mussar they're giving us, the message about eating and our relationship to food, as I mentioned. Are you tasting your food? Are you experiencing the texture of your food? These are questions that sometimes we'll stop and ask our children at our dinner table, especially when I see that, and I'm not saying I'm the best at it either, but boy, can you sometimes just sit down and shovel that in and not really taste your food and not really chew and experience the texture? And especially if it's, you know, foods that you normally consume and you eat all the time, are you stopping to do that? I think Yom Kippur and fasting, as much as, I'm pushing this piece, but I think it's tucked in the notion of having all these pieces of the quilt, all what's stitched in here in the weave of this tapestry of Yom Kippur. I think that to develop a healthy relationship with food and with our eating, a day of stopping, of fasting, is not simply because of, again, like the sinful nature and that we need to fast because of our expiation, of our hope for expiation, but the relationship we need to build and rebuild with the food that we experience as a gift. It doesn't taste like dust. It grows out of the earth, but it doesn't taste like dust. To the snake, it tastes like dust. Swallowing it whole. And yes, they miss certain foods, and curiously, it's the same list as. But these are interesting tastes. You know, can you really think about, you know, what your favorite cucumber ever tasted like? Can you think about what the melon tasted like? Can you think about your favorite leek, your onion, your garlic? Like, each of these for me has become something that I do a little differently here and there in things that I like to cook. We have different dishes for leeks in our family. We like to eat biblically, what can I say? And I've tried different, we've tried soups, purees, as dipping sauces. We do leeks with sesame oil and Asian. We do roasted on trays of vegetables. We include leeks in our diet. And I always kind of, you know, bring Torah to life in any way you can is one of my mottos in my house. My kids think it's very funny. But you bring Torah to life. And you really do experience things in a different way. And I think the kavanah for Yom Kippur, that you should really then make it a time where you're taking a break and you're re-upping the ante on your experience of the table, is real. And coming out through these sources and these texts for me, Next time we're going to see that the Gemara is going to relate to coriander. I have a whole botanist. I have a whole botanist's report, and I have lots of about the ancient world and coriander to share. I have some articles about food in general that we'll take a look at that came out of humanistic Jewish journal that I take a look at sometimes. And we'll continue along in the Gemara. It will move from man, an exploration of more about food, to a little bit about some of the other areas that Yom Kippur is concerned with.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to just interject, and you probably know this. I think it's in the Buddhist tradition. They say you should chew your liquids and drink your salt. In other words, to chew a solid food so much before you swallow it, then it's liquid.
Wow.
And you should savor your liquids.
That's lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good learning with you.